This week on The Right Side, the Oil Sands Advisory Group in Alberta unveils measures that limit growth. Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin is retiring. Questions of national security with a high-tech company sale to China. And is Trudeau enacting his platform of real change? This is The Right Side, Episode 21, recorded Saturday, June 17th, 2017. Real change? Hello, everybody, and you are listening to The Right Side. The Right Side is a podcast that aims to cut through all the bias and sensationalism in the mainstream media. This week, I'm here with Patrick, co-host of The Right Side. Welcome back.
It's good to be back, as always, on a lovely June day, and just amazing to see all the stuff that's happened in the news recently.
Yeah, we have quite the news rundown this week. We typically try and do one BC, one Alberta, and two Canada, but situation necessitated this week that we actually do three Canadas in total, including our firing line, but that's getting a little bit ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, and for those who've been following the BC election news recently, there hasn't really been that much change, which is why instead we're going to be talking about some things that are happening federally that probably haven't received that much coverage, and instead we're going to be doing that instead of a BC story, where really all is quiet on the Western Front so far, but the real thing's going to happen next week, and we'll have a bigger story, I think, to talk about next week.
Fingers crossed, providing we can make that happen. But you and I will deal with that in the post show and whatnot. Listeners need not concern themselves with it.
The only thing that they need to concern themselves with is enjoying themselves listening to us give them the Right Side news rundown, right?
That's right. So let's start with Alberta. And this week we have a headline that states, Oil Sands Advisory Group calls for emissions restrictions when the 100 megaton limit nears. So listeners and Albertans might recall, in general, that one of the core planks of Rachel Notley's environmental plan is to cap emissions from the oil sands at 100 megatons. This target is estimated to be reached sometime between 2025 and 2030. This Friday, a report was released by the Oil Sands Advisory Group, otherwise known as the OSAG, that recommends an annual forecast of greenhouse gas emissions for the next year and the next decade. These reports would look at the 10-year forecast and would examine if the 100-megaton limit was in danger of being exceeded in the next 5 years. It also recommends that the Minister of Energy or Environment be given additional powers. The ministry would then enact stricter actions if the barrier was in danger of being reached. The ministry would also get more powers. Specifically, as read from the article, the Minister of Environment or Energy would also have the authority to suspend project approval of facilities that have not yet started construction. Along with the release of this report, Minister of Environment Shannon Phillips announced that Sephora Berman would be leaving the OSAG. Berman is an environmental activist who took radical positions such as blocking all pipelines, keeping the majority of the oil in the ground, has called the oil sands the most destructive blemish on the planet, and has equated the Fort McMurray area with Mordor from Lord of the Rings.
It's not quite that bad.
Indeed. The energy industry is ultimately still recovering from the fall in oil prices and has and the other various planks of NDP policy, such as the increases in corporate taxes and a potential royalty review, and now has more uncertainty when it comes to starting new projects. Oil companies work a decade in advance from when their projects will come online. Investment is likely to be slow to return if there's a possibility that a government ministry could possibly single-handedly terminate a project. While the Rose leader Brian Jean says that this possibility would further chill investment in the oil and gas sector and are a clear cap on economic growth. And everyone ultimately needs to remember that when the Alberta economy is strong, Albertans prosper, and when Alberta prospers, Canada prospers. So this is a story that was published in the CBC and online with various other outfits, including Global and the Calgary Sun, I believe. But the main avenue they took was that the member of the Oil Sands Advisory Group, Zipporah Berman, was leaving the group. And their coverage did not go too far into the additional powers that the ministry would be granted or what these reports would ultimately take into account. And when you think of it, a report that recommends a ministry or the minister be given additional powers to single-handedly suspend approval of a facility that has not yet started construction, that's huge news for the energy sector in Alberta, and especially in Western Canada, because these projects cost billions of dollars to develop, years to plan, and are planned a decade in advance. So one only needs to look at the language of this report and the powers that could be given to realize that this is going to create a great deal of uncertainty for companies that are wanting to start up new projects.
Yeah, and that's a big problem when it comes to governments and business, is that when it comes to business and things like the environment and investment and industry, things happen on a decade long span, right? Everything happens far into the future, and these targets are set. Whereas governments can fall any year, or even majority governments are only four to five years long. So, the criticism is often that the government is just trying to make things look good in the short term when they're not capable of doing things in the long term. And I think a good example of a government trying to do good things in the long term is probably Saskatchewan's government, where they actually do have a lot of long-term policy in place because they know that they're probably going to get reelected again because they're quite popular. But in other cases, things can happen on a very quick time base in politics, whereas a lot of these industry things, it doesn't move that fast.
Right. And, you know, to put it in this way, we're potentially only two majority governments away in Alberta from reaching this five-year period where the 100-megaton cap is likely to be hit. And that puts us at the 2019 election, 2023, and then ultimately 2027 if we do elect three majority governments in a row, where governments will be dealing with the outcomes of this report and this policy. And given the current state of the economy, I personally don't think that it's a good idea to be capping emissions at this level where it's going to defer investments. I mean, sure, it's great to have an emission cap, and there definitely should be something like that in place to ensure that the environment is clean and the oil companies are doing their job. But when it's so short-sighted like this that it is effectively going to start limiting investment this year or next year, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
If these targets were for somewhere around the lines of 2050, then perhaps that would be a more workable solution.
Yeah, and I remember targets that Stephen Harper used to set had 2050 as the big goal for a lot of his environmental targets and other things like that, just because with all the changes in government, it's hard to really have a more short-term goal, because even a change in government can reverse a lot of the decisions that the previous government has done, which we are actually seeing nowadays in with the Trudeau government trying to reverse a lot of the Harper decisions
right.
that were made.
And, you know, speaking of change, there's also the idea of change in technology, because if you looked in the 1990s, hydraulic fracturing or fracking for a way of extracting oil and gas, that really wasn't that popular in the 1990s, whereas today that's one of the most popular ways to get oil out of the ground. So who knows what kind of technology we will discover in the next 10 to 15 years that could ultimately be a lower emission than what we have now.
Mm-hmm.
So really short-sighted, and I think this is ultimately a lesson to all governments that rather than planning a decade down the line when the industry works in decade time periods, they should be planning two or three decades down the line or even further to 2050. So But, you know, once again, there's very little discussion about this in the Global and Calgary Sun stories. The CBC had a few paragraphs about it, which I do commend. So, good job. Mm-hmm. All right. What do we got for our first Canada story?
Well, the first Canada story is what I think is very, very important, and that is that the Supreme Court Chief Justice Beverly McLaughlin is about to retire. She announced on June 12th that she will be retiring from the bench effective December 15th, 2017, which is 9 months before her mandatory retirement age of 75. Now, for those of you who don't know, Beverly McLaughlin, she's from BC, and a lot of people in BC really like her quite a bit for, you know, standing up for British Columbia in the Supreme Court and whatnot. And she's been there for quite a while. Now, she was appointed before I was actually born. She was appointed by Mulroney to the Supreme Court on March 30th, 1989, and then became Chief Justice under the Chrétien government. That was on January 7th, 2000. So she's been there for quite some time, almost, I think, almost 30 years at this point. And so she's shaped the Supreme Court by quite a bit, because when you look at who the next justice was that was appointed, it was Rosalie Abella under Paul Martin, and then all of the rest have come under Stephen Harper in the last 5 to 6 years or so, and the latest one, of course, by Justin Trudeau just last year. So she's by far the longest tenured judge on the Supreme Court, and when she retires, that's going to create not just an opening for a Supreme Court justice, but also a Chief Justice. And the fact that there's only one fairly long tenured person after that, it's going to create quite the decision for Trudeau. And the fact that she's been there for so long, it's going to create quite a bit of change in how the Supreme Court works, I believe. Now, this is going to be something that Trudeau is going to have to think about very carefully, because the position of a Supreme Court justice in Canada has a bit of a difference than in the States. Now, where the States, they have to worry about getting elected and that sort of thing, and they have to worry about their own popularity. The Supreme Court in Canada is fairly long arms reach away from government, and they're fairly independent in the way that they do things. So a lot of the time you'll find that the government and the Supreme Court can often clash quite a bit on certain decisions. We saw this with Harper quite frequently. Even though he had appointed 6 of the 9 justices, a lot of the time they disagreed with him on a lot of different things. Of course, you could just say that the disagreements came from, constitutional precedents and legal precedents, because we know that Harper was, I think no matter what you think of him politically, I think you could say that he was a very ambitious prime minister, and he did try and get a lot of things done. Some of it may not have been constitutionally sound, so that did set up quite a bit of the disagreements there between him and the Supreme Court. Now with McLaughlin retiring, it's going to be quite a change to how the Supreme Court works and what their decisions are going to be, based on the fact that she's the longest serving there for quite a while. Now, there's something that's been interesting that the Trudeau government has put out recently, and that is that they have actually opened up the replacement process for all candidates from all part of Canada. Now, this is something that has a lot of people scratching their heads, because the regional representation is generally a very fairly well-established tradition in the Supreme Court. Now, it's set in law that there has to be three judges that understand Quebec law because they do have a separate civil law system from the rest of the English common law system, and that's been that way for quite some time. But and it's also been a tradition that there's also three from Ontario and then one from Atlantic Canada and then two from the West. Now, if they open it up, that means that there will be only one Supreme Court justice from the West, one from Atlantic Canada, three from Ontario, three from Quebec, and then one from wherever they're going to pick. So if they mess up that regional representation, the West is going to be severely underrepresented in the Supreme Court, considering that our population growth in the West far outstrips the rest of the country, really. So it's going to be something that's going to be we're going to have to keep an eye on this and look at what's going to happen with who Trudeau is going to appoint to the bench to begin with, and then who he's going to pick as the Supreme Justice. Now, as I said before, Rosalie Abella is the longest tenured one since the Martin government, and then all the rest after that have been appointed since 2011. So one would think that she would be the choice to become the Chief Justice, right? But this is not always the case, because if you look at in the United States, their Supreme Chief Justice, rather, wasn't the longest tenured justice that was there. So he could make the decision to appoint a new judge as the Chief Justice. He could appoint Malcolm Rowe, who was Justin Trudeau's appointment back in 2016. He could be the Chief Justice. There's really no legal precedent for this. So even though Harper has six of the nine appointees on the bench, this is going to be something that Justin Trudeau will be looking at, and he could have a very large impact on the way that the Supreme Court moves forward.
And one thing I think that it's going to be very telling is whether or not this appointment follows what he set out of the open nomination process to the court, as you mentioned, where the person can be from any region of the country. If he goes continuing ahead in an attempt to create gender parity, as he did with his cabinet, and diversity as well. Now, you can argue that all these things are fine and dandy, allowing anyone to apply for the position, any judge that is, allowing for a gender parity on the court and diversity as well. But at the same time, the question is, should this amount of thought and meticulous nature of changing the way appointments are made be done to such an institution that is at the core of our democracy? And I think based on what Trudeau does, it'll say a lot about his term as prime minister and how much he is going out there to either affect his agenda of real change that he campaigned on, or if he is going to allow the Supreme Court to be the institution that it has been for the last 150 years. It's going to be a huge discussion whichever way he chooses. And I think if he goes the way of maintaining the court to be its own institution as it has been and doesn't follow any of his proclamations, I guess you could say, that he made during the campaign, then you will see that perhaps the real change agenda isn't all it was set out to be.
Yeah, and I think that's something we saw with the Senate as well, in that when he was still the third party, he basically disbanded the Liberal caucus in the Senate and said, "You're all independent now." And now he's actually running into a lot of problems with the Senate because now that they're
trying to rewrite his budget.
Exactly. And this was, I think, something that Harper understood quite a bit about the Senate, is that he originally, back when he was first elected, he wanted to either abolish the Senate or get them elected, you know, the Triple E Senate that the Reform Party campaigned on for years. And I think I think once he got into power, he understood how the Senate could work for him, and he started bit by bit, he started appointing more conservative senators as time went on, until near the end, where he didn't appoint any at all and left quite a few vacancies.
And, you know, he took a lot of fire for that in conservative circles, for not stacking the deck before he left as prime minister.
Mm-hmm. But I think it was quite a principled thing to do.
Yeah, it was. And that just proves a lot about Harper, the prime minister. But, you know, I think we're talking about the Senate right now, but the Supreme Court in that regard is pretty much the same thing, in that if Trudeau attempts to change the court the way he changed the Senate, it's a hallmark for his prime ministership. And if he doesn't change it, well, that just proves he's another liberal who is abandoning campaign promises.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is something that when we're talking about appointments here, this is something else that's been going on in the news quite a bit as well. And that was the appointments of nonpartisan people to nonpartisan portfolios. And this is the case when it comes to especially the ethics commissioner, when their pick to become the new ethics commissioner, Madeleine Meilleur, she was a very, very prominent liberal from Ontario and a former Ontario cabinet minister, and they were trying to appoint her as a nonpartisan person to a nonpartisan portfolio, which would be, you know, which would be a watchdog on how the federal government works. Now, this is something that, if you've been watching Question Period, like me, a political science nerd, does quite often, you'll see that the Conservatives and the NDP and the Bloc have all been lambasting the Liberals over this decision, just because she is so clearly partisan for the Liberals. And it turns out that the campaign to get them to withdraw the nomination worked, as she herself actually did, even though the Liberals were staying behind her 100%. And she was actually saying things to the official commission that the Minister of Heritage, Melanie Joly, was actually contradicting her in the House of Commons, which is quite a big no-no when you look at it, because you'll have a majority government lying to the rest of the House of Commons. That's quite a big thing. Now, it's also interesting to note that the Federal Ethics Commissioner and the lobbying watchdogs that Trudeau has to appoint people to, he's actually extending those the terms of them because he doesn't want to try and replace them. So he's actually extended the term by another 6 months just recently, and
we'll talk they more were actually about that supposed after. But it feels as though it is kind of what's happening in the U.S., but different, and that's interesting.
Yeah, and he's actually postponed it by another 6 months, and they were actually supposed to leave their jobs just in a few weeks, and he still hasn't made any point of trying to replace them. Now, online, they've been putting out opportunities for these commissioners, much like they're doing with the Supreme Court justice, and they're trying to say that they have a very open process, but in the end, look at what happened with the ethics commissioner, and look at what happened with the official languages commissioner. They just picked a very partisan liberal appointee anyways. So I think the real question that we have to gain from this is, are they going to be open and transparent like they said they would, or are they just going to make it look like they are and then be partisan anyways? It's really is quite two-faced of them to do that. And I think when it comes to the Supreme Court, if they try and do the same thing, there's going to be a lot of questions raised by a lot of people.
Oh, yeah. Lots of lawyers, lots of constitutional experts. Because, you know, commissioners and appointed positions are one thing, but the Supreme Court, so essential to democracy, I don't think it's a good idea to play experiments with that. But
no, and they really shouldn't be playing political games at this point,
exactly,
which is what they are doing.
All right. So what else are they doing with China? I mean,
so
if you know about a Chinese takeover story here, and that doesn't sound good. So what do you got?
Yeah. So there is a takeover of a high-tech firm in Vancouver, and that's called Norsat International. And Norsat is a company with a bunch of military customers because it's a company that has patented satellite communications technology, and we also share that with our allies. And it's technology used for security, public safety, as well as defense, which is very important. And it's something that we that is shared with NATO as well. Customers that Norsat lists on its website include the U.S. Department of Defense, the U.S. Marine Corps, the U.S. Army, the Irish Department of Defense, the Taiwanese Army, the aircraft manufacturing company Boeing, and major journalism outfits including CBS News as well as Reuters. So the company that is buying them is called Hyterra Communications, and they're based out of Shenzhen, China. And it's something that's very, very interesting because in the past, the Harper government has actually vetoed takeovers by Chinese corporations based that there wasn't any guarantee that national security wouldn't be compromised. But now it seems like the Trudeau liberals are letting this go through. And in fact, they're waiving mandatory security reviews for these purchases. Now, if you remember one of our first episodes that we did back in February, I think it was maybe 5 or 6, I talked about how a Chinese company with murky ownership structure was buying the a large BC chain of retirement homes, and it was giving China a foothold into Canada's healthcare sector. And in, back in March, they also approved a takeover of ITF Technologies Incorporated, which Harper had originally blocked because it would undermine a technological edge that Western militaries had over China. And now they're letting China buy Norsat, which is a very big deal in defense for NATO as well.
Yeah.
And it's just it seems like they don't see what the problem is.
Yeah, here. And you know, I think this ultimately comes down to a couple things. There was a – before Justin Trudeau was prime minister, and his third party leader was a social in Toronto where he called China his favorite basic dictatorship. We also have the relationship that his dad, Trudeau Sr., had with China, and Trudeau has much the same relationship with China. As you guys will probably recall if you watch the news, that the highlight out of Trudeau's China trip was they gave him the nickname Small Potato, and that was something the media enjoyed reporting on. So it is no surprise that the Trudeau government feels close ties with China, and, you know, you got to look at what China is doing. China is an emerging economic superpower and has been for a number of years. And China cares about its economic bottom line and making sure that it is going to be profitable in the future, even if it is a crony capitalist structure. That is where the folks at the top benefit most over the ordinary civilians. So with that being said, anytime dealings are done with China, the government needs to be on their toes and be watching out for any ulterior motives that China may have. And with this takeover, it certainly doesn't seem like the government is too concerned about that, because this is a high-tech firm that provides technology, as you said, to the United States Army, among others. So it's a little bit concerning. In fact, very concerning.
Yeah, and it's something that the Conservatives in the House of Commons have been going after the government in question period, which, once again, I've been watching a lot of recently. And whenever they're asked, if Trudeau isn't there, it is the Innovation, Science, and Economic Development Minister, Navdeep Bains, who has been defending the government position on that. And he was saying that it was decided in the security screening analysis that an in-depth security review by CSIS and the Department of National Defense was, quote, not necessary. And he also said that there are measures under the National Security Review that we feel we are unable to share with the public, but if after an initial review we feel we need to investigate further, we do that. And it's something that he's been saying quite a bit of in Parliament, and that he's been saying that national security is their number one priority, and they oversee all transactions that take place, and they check all the boxes, and we did our homework on this issue, and he's been saying that over and over again. Now, when Trudeau came back, and he was present for question period, Andrew Scheer went after Trudeau as well, seeing if he could get a clarification of the position. And guess what? He said the exact same thing. National security is our number one priority. We checked all the boxes, and we did all our homework. It's the same talking point. It makes you wonder if the innovation minister was handed his answers directly from the PMO, or if it was something that they're just sticking to and they're not going to give any other information on it.
Yeah, and you know, there's huge alarm bells for this because this really isn't being talked about in the mainstream media at all. This week on the nightly news, which is where most people are going to find this unless they frequent the politics sections of the various newspapers, the Globe and Mail in this case. And this sets off alarm bells not only for this, but also any potential trade deals that might be coming out of China as well.
Mm-hmm. And it also sets off alarm bells for the transparency issue that Trudeau has been campaigning on quite a bit, and the fact that he would let his ministers be more free with how they answer questions, and the fact that he's giving the same answers, it really does raise alarm bells, you know. And the fact that they're being so close-lipped about this, they're trying to say that it's because of national defense, but if they're waiving the security review, it's clearly not about national defense, is it?
Yeah. And I mean, if you're going to waive national defense for one country in terms of security reviews, you think it would be the United States. I don't think we'd want to waive them with China or Russia or any other countries for that matter. But this is a big deal and needs to be looked at. And I think that's a good time to move on to our firing line segment with that.
Mm-hmm.
So firing line is, of course, a segment that has been reported on or completely ignored by the mainstream media in the news. And this week we have one from the Toronto Star. Is this Stephen Harper, Justin Trudeau, running things on Parliament Hill? A stalled appointment process, a botched attempt at installing a member of the Liberal family in a post that requires total independence from the government, a unilateral bid to change the rules of the House of Commons. Oh, and we just talked about two of those, didn't we?
Yeah, and we could have talked about the changing the rules of the House of Commons, because they said that they wanted to change the House of Commons to work better for the people, but in reality, a lot of the changes would make them work better for the Liberal Party.
Indeed.
Or the government in power. So,
the author goes
what do you
on
got
to,
for us here?
The author goes on to highlight each of these points. Trudeau hasn't filled a single parliamentary watchdog vacancy area, which you were just talking about. Trudeau also justifies delays in the appointment process due to the quest for a merit-based system. Those were the government's actual words. The information commissioner found that the government transparency has actually decreased since Trudeau came to power. And Trudeau has promised to be more respectful to Parliament and the opposition parties, but in reality has been very unilateral in his approach with dealing with the House.
What a shocker.
Liberal Party insiders also say that Trudeau's heart is in the right place, and the big leap forward was on a gender parity cabinet and diversity. And this will showcase the differences in the next election between this government and the previous government and make the wait for appointments no big deal.
So let me get this straight. He wants a merit-based system, but then he appointed, you know, a gender parity cabinet without any real question of merit. He's basically trying to have it both ways, is he not?
Yeah. So, you know, when you look at this from a point-by-point perspective, you see that this article is entirely true and has been missed in most part by most of the mainstream media, because let's face it, you turn on the nightly news and the first story is about President Trump and the Russia investigation. Even though we're in Canada, and I think people in Canada would like to see Canadian-based news first, though that might be an unpopular opinion. Anyways, much of the last election campaign, I think, was focused on the Liberals' real change platform and modernizing the institution of Parliament and government in general. I think we can both agree with that. That's how they put the campaign on what got them elected.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the things about helping the middle class and, you know, making sure the government works for all Canadians, not just the top 1%. I think that was the quote that's now ingrained in my mind after seeing so many commercials during hockey games.
And, you know, ultimately, this is what made Trudeau so appealing to a good chunk of the voter base, including young people. And I don't think the government and the Liberal Party realizes this, but that young voter base is completely mobile and can move around between parties without questions asked. You know, one only needs to look at the disastrous U.S. midterm elections of 2010 and 2014, where the Obama Democrats lost the House and the Senate because Obama wasn't delivering on promises that he made to his key voter base, young first-time voters. And I think that, in large part, is who came out for Trudeau last time around.
Yeah, and they were the ones who were voting for the NDP back in 2011, and they switched over to Trudeau, and they were able to give the NDP their biggest result ever, as well as putting vaulting the Liberals from a third party nobodies basically back into a very strong majority government.
And, you know, much of the mainstream media last election was focused on the fresh messaging that Trudeau and the Liberals were bringing. And they gave Trudeau considerable time to sell this idea to the population. And yes, the election is over. That was 2 years ago. And today, the media should be focused on reporting accurately of how the government is doing and how that election is turning out. And this means reporting on transparency, promises kept, highlighting the slow pace at which this government is passing legislation. It was back in May on episode 16 where we talked about the fact that the government had only passed 17 bills since coming into power. And this week, the CBC has an analysis on that same idea that states that this government has only passed half the amount of bills at this time that the former Harper government did by this time in their mandate. So, as you can see, this is happening in government, and it might as well be happening behind closed doors because it's not really being talked about by the media that this government is utterly failing in terms of getting things done and delivering on its campaign platforms.
And it's also failing on a lot of transparency. The fact that they're actually saying that it's even less transparent than Harper should be a real question to a lot of people that voted Liberal, because a lot of the criticism of Harper was that he you know, he did things his way. He didn't let anyone else have any ideas. He didn't
I remember days at a time where we'd see stories on the news that Harper was muzzling scientists, and it was impossible to speak if you were a government-paid scientist about what was going on. And, you know, if one thinks that's the ultimate lack of transparency, and lots of people are saying it's gotten worse, then we have a problem.
Yeah, and one of the big things just after the election was that the Liberals have unmuzzled the federal scientists. Well, have you really heard very much of them lately? Because I sure haven't.
I think that you know, looking back on it, that could have been a media ploy about the scientists. Because I mean, if they were unmuzzled, surely they would have published what they were muzzled from publishing, and the media should have jumped on reporting that, as they should do. And you know, more and more, I think our firing line is turning into the segment where we talk about the disservice that the media is doing to the people of Canada and Alberta, BC, and in general, because each and every week, we're highlighting something that is at one point in the mainstream media, and it could be covered so much elsewhere, and it could drive news cycles, but for some reason, it's chosen not to.
So it makes you wonder with how our media is structured and how there's just a few companies that own the majority of the media structures. Is there a ploy here to make sure that we only get a certain part of the news? Or is it incompetence? I mean, I think the phrase is never attribute to malice that can be explained by incompetence, but it really makes you wonder here, right?
Indeed. And, you know, that is precisely why we do this show and why it's called The Right Side. It's to keep our listeners on the right side of the news and the media, to inform you guys with context and information of what's actually going on. And I think that this leads us nicely into our word of the week. what do we got for our word of the week this week?
Well, our word of the week this week is change. And I think that's something that we've talked about in all of our episodes or all of our news segments this week, is that change is something that politicians, like Barack Obama and Justin Trudeau, they've used the word change as the central part of their platforms, and even other others in opposition as well try and do this, and they try and make it out as if it's a supreme deity of goodness, and how change is something that will fix everything, when in reality it's really just the act or instance of making or becoming different. And the example that the dictionary gives us is the change from a nomadic to an agricultural society, or things like environmental change. And I think that's something that we all have to remember, is that change isn't a good thing. It can be good, but it can also be bad. And change is something that, when it comes to politics, it's something that you have to really think closely about, and whether you want things to change quite a bit, or if you think you should keep them the way they are. And I think that's something that was highlighted in this most recent federal election campaign, is that the Liberals campaigned basically on a platform of change, real change that we could all believe in. And the fact that they're not really changing that much, and that they haven't changed much since the last time they were in power, it just goes to show that if they just keep up with this outlook, there's going to be an actual real change in the next election.
Indeed. And change for the sake of change is not change. And as soon as the change happens, it becomes old. And that is precisely what we're seeing with this government, is that they were changed and they campaigned on that, but lo and behold, we see them reverting to the Liberals of the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty, well, hopefully that wasn't too depressing for our listeners out there. Hopefully you guys enjoyed that episode of The Right Side. If you guys want to find full show notes, you can find us at rightsidenews.ca. We're also on Twitter at rightsideca. And we will see you next week for what is sure to be an interesting episode after the shenanigans in BC that are about to unfold.
Yeah, and for our iTunes listeners out there, you can also grab the quick link at rightsidenews.ca/iTunes, and you can find all of our episodes there for free, and you'll be able to listen to us every single week that we come on. So we will see you next time, and we will give you the right side of the news.
Thank you always for sharing your time with us.